It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Over the years, he acquired the unofficial title as the Keeper of the Hope Diamond. That's an iconic 45-carat blue gemstone. And after decades working for the Smithsonian, mineralogist Jeffrey Post is retiring to his beloved Wisconsin. We explore precious gems and minerals, and you can join the conversation. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeffrey Post is recently retired, a curator in charge of gems and minerals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. Jeffrey, welcome to the Ideas Network. Welcome back to Wisconsin.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you this morning.
Yes.
And I should just say, I'm not actually back in Wisconsin. I was back in Wisconsin last week, but right now I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. But we are planning our return back to that state.
Perfect. Perfect. We'll take that. You retired in May. We got wind that you're coming this way. Why retire to Wisconsin?
Well, it's still home. My wife and I both grew up in the Madison area, and we spent summers there with our family, visiting my parents, and I still have sisters and family and nieces and nephews there. And so, every time I get off a plane or we drive home, it's home once we're back in Wisconsin. So we're kind of looking forward to being home again.
Oh, what a homecoming. I love to hear that. Why turning to your to your profession? Why are people so fascinated by gems?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? I think it's there's a lot of reasons. I mean, gems have a lot of different appeals to people. I mean, in some cases, it's just looking at them and saying, what a beautiful thing, right? They are gorgeous. There's also the fact that gems are permanent. Unlike if you look at a flower, it looks beautiful, but a few days later, it's faded, it's gone. A gemstone's going to keep that beauty basically forever. And so I think we're kind of fascinated by something that has that that perpetual permanence of beauty. And then, of course, they're valuable, and most of them come with a story. Every time I put a gemstone in someone's hands, it seems the first thing they ask is, who owned this? Where did it come from? And so I think we associate them with interesting people, with history, and all of those things together just make them fascinating to us.
How do you handle them or clean them? Do they need to be cleaned when they're behind glass?
Oh, they do. It's funny. We, as much as we think we've got airproof or dustproof cases with tens of thousands of people coming through our exhibits every day, it seems dust finds its way in. And so it's a perpetual problem. We're always opening cases. And, we have, the same kinds of cloths probably used for cleaning off your glasses or other sensitive optical materials. We're wiping them. Sometimes we dunk them in a little bit of water and clean them off and put them back out. Because one thing we've learned is if the gems don't look absolutely sparkling, our visitors let us know pretty quickly.
What are your favorite minerals or gems from the gems exhibit at the Smithsonian?
Oh, that's a tough one, right? A colleague of mine once used to like to say, I've never met a mineral I didn't love. And I guess I'm a little bit in the same category. But, any given day, I could go out into the exhibit and I could point to something and we could start talking about it. And that might be my favorite for the day. But it is hard to get past the fact that the Hope Diamond has taken up a huge amount of time and attention from the time I started working at the Smithsonian. It is a diamond that gets a lot of attention, has a lot of fascination for people. And it's still pretty amazing to me that you look at this 1-inch diameter blue diamond and think of all of the history, all of the stories, all of the books, the movies, everything that's been done, the thousands of people that come each day to see this. And you got to kind of look at it and you go, wow, that's pretty amazing. This one diamond has caused such a stir and has gotten so much attention.
I think I know what's going through your mind as you clean it. Jeffrey Post with us, mineralogist, recently retired from the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, as we talk about one of the largest collections of gems and minerals. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Join in with your questions or your comments. Can you talk a little bit about that history of the Hope Diamond and the lore of this 45-carat blue diamond?
Sure. The quick version, because it can go on for a long time, is it's a diamond that was found in India in the late 1600s. It was sold to King Louis XIV of France. It became part of the French crown jewels. During the French Revolution, it was stolen from the French crown jewels. And the recut version of that stone, which is the Hope Diamond, appeared for sale in London in the early 1800s. It became part of the collection of Henry Philip Hope, who was a banker who had a great gem collection. And it's the Hope family name, of course, that goes with the diamond today. And then eventually one of his descendants was forced to sell the diamond, and it changed hands several times, but ultimately was purchased by a woman who lived in Washington, D.C. Her name was Evelyn Walsh McLean. And it was really about the time that she bought the diamond that people started talking about, you know, the fact that maybe there was a curse or bad luck on this diamond. And in part, it was a story to help get the diamond some attention to help sell it. But also, once it was owned by this very famous and wealthy woman, you know, she liked to tell the stories. And then a few unfortunate things happened in her life. She lost a son at an early age, a daughter committed suicide. And so people who like to believe in bad luck said, well, gee, look at all the terrible things happening to this wealthy lady who owns this diamond. And of course, the diamond got the blame for all those things.
Is it true when it was donated to the Smithsonian, it was sent through the post office, through the mail?
Well, so after Evelyn Walsh McLean passed away in 1946, her collection, including the Hope Diamond, was sold to Harry Winston, the jeweler in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And he traveled the diamond around the United States as part of what he called his Court of Jewels exhibit. So a lot of people had a chance to see it. It got a lot of attention. And then he decided in 1958 to donate the diamond to the Smithsonian. And certainly it was good publicity for him, but also he had this vision that we should start a great national gem collection. He said, even though we don't have a crown jewels, a king and a queen, we should have our own national gem collection. So he donated the diamond, and being a little bit, you know, the salesman, the flamboyant jeweler, you know, he didn't just quietly put it in his pocket and bring it down to Washington, D.C. and say, here it is. No, he put it in the mail and insured it for $1 million. And it was then delivered by a postman to the museum the next day. A bunch of people were waiting in the gallery for the mailman to arrive, and it was unwrapped and immediately put on exhibit. And so it was just kind of a fun way to introduce this diamond to everybody in the United States and say, here it is at the Smithsonian.
I'm glad it arrived safely. Let's talk a little bit about the glow. It glows orange under UV light. Why is that?
Well, you know, the diamond, in addition to being a fabulous gemstone, is also a really interesting mineral, a really interesting diamond. And the diamond is a blue color. The blue color is because of trace amounts, parts per million, of the element boron. And so the fact that it's blue made it a very intriguing diamond in itself, and one of the reasons why it's rare and valuable. But in the 1960s, scientists studying it realized that when you expose the diamond to ultraviolet light in a dark room and then turn off the ultraviolet light, it would glow a bright orange. And it's pretty bright. It's a property called phosphorescence, and it would glow for about a minute. And so for people who like to believe in curses are going, wow, this is even better than I could imagine. You know, here's this diamond that's supposedly cursed, and it glows a blood red color when you put an ultraviolet light on it. Well, we were curious to know what causes that. And so we've actually done some measurements in the last few years. And with modern spectrometers and things, we're able to determine that, in fact, it's the same impurity, boron, that gives it the blue color that also causes this phosphorescence. So it's not the curse. It's actually a very interesting scientific property of the diamond that causes it to do this.
Is it the phosphorescence that then gives it the glow even when the lights go out after a minute?
That's it. I mean, basically, when you expose the diamond to ultraviolet light, it excites electrons, and when you turn off the light, those electrons lose their energy. They drop back to a lower energy state, and they give off that excess energy in the form of that orange-red light that is the phosphorescence glow.
Jeffrey Post, former curator in charge of gems and minerals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. You can be part of the discussion about rare gemstones. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the legendary Hope Diamond and other famous stones on display at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. The curator of the museum's gems and minerals is set to retire to Wisconsin. And we have mineralogist Jeffrey Post here answering your questions. Let's bring in Lisa in Milwaukee. Hi, Lisa. What is your question?
Good morning. Hey, I was thinking the other day about this. Does it concern you or anyone when you deal with real diamonds that so many of the, I call them GMO diamonds that are being sold today are replacing the real diamonds? And I do not like to be fake. You know what I mean? If I want something, I really want it to be real. So I was just wondering, does that concern you about the, does it take from the real diamonds?
Lisa, thank you. Are you talking about like growing diamonds in the lab?
Yes.
Jeffrey, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And it has really caused some interesting issues within the whole diamond market. I think everyone is still trying to figure out what the impact of lab-grown diamonds is going to be on the sales of natural diamonds in terms of what consumers are told and what they're interested in buying. And so far, lab-grown diamonds have gotten a lot of attention. And, they are actual diamonds. They're just grown in a factory or laboratory as opposed to grown in the earth. And so in terms of their structure, their mineralogy, they're exactly the same. So they are real diamonds. The difference is they didn't come out of the earth. And so for some people, that makes a big difference. They want a diamond that form naturally in the earth and everything, all the story that goes with that. Others just want something that's big and glittery and maybe at a slightly lower price. And so for them, a lab-grown diamond may be the perfect choice. And I think that's what's playing out right now in the industry, and no one quite knows how it's going to work. But there's no doubt there are more and bigger lab-grown diamonds out there, and the price has dropped, and everyone's trying to figure out what part of the market niche they're going to be occupying.
Lisa, thank you for calling in. Jeffrey, what makes a gem or mineral worthy of being featured in the Smithsonian's collections?
There are a number of factors that we consider. First of all, we are looking for gemstones or minerals that are representative of what has come out of the earth that may have an interesting story to tell. Nowadays, we're looking for gems or minerals that might add something new to the collection. We're always looking for something that is really spectacular in terms of beauty or that has a great story to go along with it. And so each opportunity to add something to the collection is sort of a thoughtful discussion amongst my colleagues and myself. And, does it fit in the collection? Is it something we can tell a story about? Is it something the public will find interesting?
Let's go to Tim in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Yeah, I was curious to know what the rarest gem is, what it's made out of or how it was formed, and what makes it so valuable.
Thank you, Tim.
Well, Tim, okay, that's a good question. You know, the answer to what is the rarest gem has changed over time as, you know, various new deposits are discovered. Something that was thought to be very rare, suddenly a new discovery makes it less rare. For example, there's a gemstone that came out of Burma many years ago that is called pudretite. And it was the only gemstone of that. It's only one example of that known. And so for a long time, it was considered to be the rarest gemstone. And then once people realized what it was, they started looking for it in other deposits and in fact did find some. It's still very rare, but less rare than it was. Likewise, is another gem. If you look up online, what is the rarest gemstone? Often what you'll hear is a mineral called painite. And again, the same thing. When they were looking for other gems, they found this one unknown crystal in there, and somebody cut it into a gemstone, realized it was this very rare mineral, and so that became the rarest gem. Well, now since then, they found other examples. So a lot of what makes a gemstone rare is, how many of them are known, but also in some cases, it's a particularly large example of a certain gem that makes it rare, or something that's just particularly beautiful. So all of these different attributes can make something rare and valuable. It just depends on the gemstone.
The history, the story, the science all coming together there. Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So, Dr. Post, I was wondering if you noticed during your time at the Smithsonian if there's any type of universal structure to gems and minerals. Like, I mean, I'm not talking about the composition of the elements, but the actual shape that they configure in.
So, Marcus, that's an interesting question. I mean, all of gems and minerals have a unique structure, which is what makes them the particular gem they are, a beryl or a diamond or a corundum or ceph. All of those have their own unique atomic structure. And so there's not any one structure pattern that is common or that links all different kinds of gems. However, once they're cut and polished, there's a lot of, you know, certain shapes that are very typical or common to all the different gems because they best show off the optical properties or the beauty of the stones. So cutters have imposed sort of a uniform look or structure on a lot of these gems, but what nature produced initially, each one has its own unique structure, its own unique sort of configuration, and that's what makes it what it is.
What about like I think it's the Oppenheimer that's uncut versus
yes.
one that is cut, like the Hope Diamond. What would be a difference there?
Well, the Oppenheimer diamond, it's, you know, that's our largest diamond crystal in the collection. It's 254 carats, so a big diamond crystal. And it's shaped, they call it octahedral shape. You imagine two pyramids stuck base to base. So it has eight sides to it. And it's a beautiful thing as it is. And that's the crystal that came out of the earth. And of course, to be cut into a gemstone, a gem cutter would then start with a crystal like that and would shape and facet it to produce the shape that we're familiar with in cut diamonds that best reflects light and shows off the beauty of the diamond. And so when you make that transformation, it goes from being a mineral crystal to now being a gemstone. And once it's a gemstone, of course, we think about it in all different ways than we ever did as a crystal.
Interesting. Jeffrey Post, mineralogist, recently retired as curator in charge of gems and minerals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your question. Jeffrey, Connor from Fort Atkinson called in, and Connor is wondering your thoughts on the Eagle Diamond that was at the American Museum of Natural History before it was stolen. The gem was discovered in Eagle, Wisconsin.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of a sad story, isn't it? That one of the great diamonds that came out of Wisconsin. And, you know, there have been a number of diamonds found in Wisconsin, almost always in gravel deposits. So probably as the result of glaciers moving those diamonds maybe from Canada down into Wisconsin at some point. But that particular diamond, which is one of the most well-known ones from the state, was, of course, featured on display at the Natural History Museum in New York. And in 1964, I think it was, they had a theft of their gems. The thief got some notoriety. He was known in the newspapers as Murph the Surf. He was a beach bum sort of that became a gem thief. And a number of the major stones that were stolen at that time were eventually recovered, found in a bus locker in Miami. But unfortunately, the diamonds that were stolen, almost none of them were found again. And the trouble with diamonds, of course, is they can be recut so they don't look like they did before, or a rough diamond like the Eagle Diamond could be cut. And once it's been cut and put into the back into the market, you just don't recognize it again. So unfortunately, as far as we know, that diamond has been lost, and probably once it was stolen, was immediately sold, recut, and I'm afraid we'll probably never see it again.
Well, in retirement, very quickly here, will you be able to spend some time at Cave of the Mounds or other places to get your minerals on?
Well, my wife and I are looking forward to exploring much of the state of Wisconsin. It's probably one of the big incentives. You know, there's so much interesting and beautiful to see in Wisconsin. And we're looking at, you know, being somewhere in the Madison area, partly because I'm hoping to keep some connection there with the university and a chance to still do a little bit of research and, you know, get to spend time with colleagues there. But also, I will probably be popping back and forth to the Smithsonian every once in a while to finish up some projects there and the nice thing is that there are minerals everywhere. And so there will not be a shortage of things to look at. And one of the things that I think my wife is still getting used to realizing is that what I did for my profession most of my life is also what I enjoy doing for my hobby. I don't think I'm going to stop enjoying gems and minerals just because I'm retired. And so it is one of the fun parts of looking forward to being in Wisconsin.
All the best to you. Jeffrey Post, recently retired as curator in charge of gems and minerals at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.